From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is InSight. I'm Beth Ruyak. That human caravan of migrants from Honduras is still on the move. President Trump has called it a national emergency. And this is one of a number of stories headlining international news today. Let's start there with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Beth.
Let's do talk about this caravan. And I think in this conversation, the political implications are powerful, with President Trump talking about sanctions as well as calling it a national emergency.
Well, this is what the president has been focusing on even when before he was President Trump, and that is illegal immigration and the lack of a border security. He did that on the day he announced his candidacy in 2015, and he's doing it again now. Basically, he's going around the country and blaming the Democrats for weak border security, allowing this illegal immigration into the country. And when you see thousands of migrants, you know, in this caravan coming from Honduras and Guatemala, going through Mexico, headed for the U.S. border, this only buttresses the president's argument and the Republican argument that immigration and border security is a top issue for the country, and it could very well sway a lot of voters.
Well, he's criticized El Salvador and Guatemala, also Honduras, also Mexico, for not stopping the group or somehow slowing down the flow of migrants. He's tweeting about it. And in the meantime, he has alerted the U.S. Border Patrol. I don't know the specifics of what the plan will be with the migrants reaching the border, but it could be captivating in the days leading up to the elections in the United States.
Oh, there's no question about that. The president has already talked about sealing the border. He's talked about at least today, if it was yesterday, talking about cutting off aid to Guatemala and Honduras for not stopping this caravan from taking place. And of course, that's so self-defeating, because basically these people are leaving their countries because of not only violence, but also dire economic situations. And so if the president is going to cut off economic aid to these countries that are already in severe distress, I mean, basically it sounds self-destructing and sounds almost like a punishment more than anything else. And basically, you know, just ignoring the plight of these people, why they are leaving to begin with.
There have been migrant caravans organized before. Of course, we heard about one earlier this year. This one apparently started October 12th, and it ebbs and flows. The estimate is about 5,000 people. Are you expecting this to be a situation that's going to get resolved pretty quickly, Ken?
Oh, I don't at all. And of course, if you remember the last caravan, and the last when they approached the border, the Trump administration got himself into hot water by separating families once they crossed the border. And apparently there are still some 500 young children still separate from their families, even though the deadline to reunite the families passed a long time ago. So, no, I don't think. Look, first of all, immigration is not going to go. The issue of immigration and illegal immigration is not going to go away anytime soon. The only political tragedy of this is that it's coming right before an election that where the president and his party can use this issue as to say that, you know, immigration is wrong. And you know, it's basically, while the Democrats are trying to talk about health care and what the Republicans are trying to hold back, Republicans are saying that Democrats are complicit in this open border policy. And it becomes, you know, these poor suffering people, and they are poor suffering people, have become political pawns.
You know, to your point, though, Ken, we don't live in a vacuum, and the world knows the timing of U.S. elections. So it is possible that the staging of caravans can be timed exactly in lockstep with a U.S. election, and that there might be a full intention of this coming to a head sometime in the late days of October, early days of November.
But that doesn't make sense to me, because, I mean, if you want to make the argument that Trump and the Republican control of Congress have been less willing to deal with immigrants and immigration than Democrats, of course, Democrats didn't do a splendid job either when they had control of the House. But if Republicans are tougher on immigration, why time this that in such a way where that could help the Republicans by making, by, you know, I mean, if you pick up any front page of a newspaper around the country, you see mobs and mobs of thousands of people heading towards the United States, and that frightens a lot of voters. So, I mean, if it is done deliberately, it also seems very self-destructive and self-defeating if it's going to be something that could aid the Republican Party, which is, not, I assume, not what these migrants would like to see happen.
So if I play devil's advocate, I say, what about the flip side, though, for people who are already frustrated and in some cases enraged about the immigration situation, to see people walking and be stopped, or the possibility of more families stopped and divided at the border, that it could have the flip effect. It could inspire Democrats or people who are very frustrated about the situation to vote. You see what I'm saying?
I do, and I think you're absolutely right in the fact that this is not a one-sided argument. I mean, it's not that this is a Republican argument and Democrats have nothing to say about it. This immigration and the border policies have, and the separation of families, have really split the country in two. And I mean, of course, most people are just, you know, aghast at what happened to the families that they were, and when children were taken away from their parents. But the fact is that immigration is not a simple issue. Neither Democrats nor Republicans have a clear answer how to deal with this. And it has split, not only split the parties in Congress, it split the voters as well. And so you can make the case that maybe perhaps Democrats could benefit from this or Republicans could benefit from it. The fact is that we are taking a political advantage of a really intolerable situation that is derived from violence and economic stress.
Right. It's one of, as I said, a number of international news stories that are playing into the domestic scene and experience of Americans right now. I'm going to mention that the INF treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, has come into the spotlight over the weekend. That might prompt a meeting between Trump and the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. But I actually want to focus on the situation with the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And the fact that Trump and Turkey's president have spoken, Ken, I know you've seen this. There are videos, photos, and pieces of the mystery that are starting to surface. This is a powerful story for Americans right now.
This is a tremendously powerful story, and this is one of the, it's tragic on so many levels, but the fact is, if you want to just talk politically, I mean, forget about what happened to the poor journalist who, by the way, lived in Virginia, was a contributor to the Washington Post, decided to live in America because of its freedoms, and then gets butchered by going into the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. And the real political tragedy is it just seems like there have been so many shifting responses coming from the White House about what has happened. And basically, it is echoing and mirroring what the Saudi regime has said. You know, first they said, Trump said, the Saudi king and the crown prince vehemently deny any involvement in it, and I believe them. Then they said, there may be rogue elements. So Trump says, it's my understanding there could be rogue elements involved in the killing. And then when they say, and then when the Saudi argument is that, Khashoggi got into a fist fight with 15 armed guards at the embassy, and that's why he was killed. Trump said, that's plausible. I mean, there's such a lack of moral leadership coming from this country, and almost an abdication, given the fact that once upon a time we were the country that would talk about freedoms and beliefs and foundations for freedom, and not all of, look, we always sold weapons and military equipment to autocratic nations. We did it under Democrats and Republicans. That has not gone away. But there's something about this particular brutal crime by an erstwhile ally, by an ally trusted by Donald Trump and Jared Kushner and his family, that has just outraged people. Even people like Lindsey Graham, who seems to bend over backwards to defend Donald Trump lately, said this is unacceptable and it cannot stand. Rand Paul said, as they're talking about either sanctions or killing the military equipment deal, but there's something about what the Americans have not done, and that is to show the moral leadership that we were once capable of doing. And I think it's a stain on this country. I really do.
We are getting a slow leak of the story. And, you know, Ken, I'd like to see a poll on how many people believed that fistfight story.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's like It's just, I mean, right, that he fell on a banana peel and hit his head. And where is the body? I mean, there's so many stories that just don't make sense. And the fact that the president, the White House, has almost agreed to whatever concoction the Saudi regime has come up with, they've agreed to it. It's just so disappointing in what has been a series of disappointing actions.
It's painful. Is what it is. But I do want to get to something from last week that we promised we would revisit. And that is that here in California, we had a debate between the senior senator on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein, and her challenger, Kevin DeLeon, a state senator. I assume that you heard at least pieces of that debate, if not all of it. Do you have any thoughts about it at this point?
Well, I do. I mean, first of all, you know, I mean, look, it was, I don't know what difference it makes, of course, because it happened in the middle of the afternoon. It was not televised.
Right.
You had to register to watch it on this cable channel or something, and which is exactly what Dianne Feinstein wanted. She did not debate her opponents in 2006 or 2012, and she almost had to be arm twisted into doing this with Kevin DeLeon. And basically, it wasn't even a debate, because not only was it the format was not like a debate, they were just listening to questions from the moderator, but Kevin DeLeon, who had an opportunity to stand up, you know, or show the differences between his vision and Dianne Feinstein's vision, failed to do it. And I don't know if it was a deliberate reason. Maybe he felt that he was so far behind in the polls, there was no reason to do it. But basically, I don't know what we learned, except for one thing. They do show two different Democratic visions of how to respond to Donald Trump. DeLeon is much more aggressive, wants to take him on, wants to keep fighting. And Feinstein says that, look, you know, we can't do it. We, the Democrats, can't do anything as long as Republicans control everything in Washington, which they do. And so her argument is that maybe we can find some ways to work across party lines. That infuriates progressives, that infuriates the activists. But that's been her strategy since she's been in the Senate. And do I think that it changes the race at all? No, I don't think Dianne Feinstein is going to, you know, have any kind of a tough struggle at all. But it does show the impatience among some Democrats about how to deal with Donald Trump, and that still remains unresolved.
Well, I had a clip from each of them in the debate, Ken, but you just summarized it so well. In fact, I think you gave it better context than what my clips would have shown. So I have to defer to the political junkie on this one.
And you're going to have to fire those production assistants who got the tape for you. It's sad that all that work went to waste.
No way. Our insight team
is... I love your staff, and you know I love your staff. And they are the best.
Well, they're golden on the days that we need six clips from a speech because I have to walk you through all of it. And we have so much. Anyway, November 6th is Election Day. 23 is the number of Republican seats the Democrats would need to flip to take control of the House. Five of those, Ken, seem to be toss-ups in California. It was as high as 7, but now 2 are seeming to split, 1 each direction. So really looking at five races right now.
Actually, I'm looking at 7.
Are you?
I mean, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? We still have 2 weeks to go. But I've been saying on your show from the beginning that if the Democrats are going to take control of the House, and right now I think they do, my number right now is 27 Democratic pickups, a net of 27, they need 23. But if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in California. And, you know, there are vulnerable seats, districts that Hillary Clinton won, districts where Republicans are retiring, districts where you have in San Diego where Duncan Hunter is under indictment.
Right.
You do have Republicans, you know, on the run. You also have some popular Republicans in Democratic-leaning districts who could survive, but it's going to be tough, and in California, unfortunately for us on the East Coast, it's going to be a late night for many of us to watch who's going to you know win control of the House. But California plays a pivotal role in that.
That's good, and I'm glad we'll have you with us, at least by voice, over the electronic lines.
I am excited to be on Capital
Night.
Public Radio, Election Night, talking about the races around the country. Absolutely.
Okay, well, we'll talk again next Monday before Election Day arrives. And Ken, as always, thanks much.
Thank you, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio.